Eoch tanuyap, kuige iwans kuyens na. Hi everybody, my name is Kuige Iwans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yogalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
I'm Macy Chan.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org.
Good morning. It is Thursday, August the 13th. And on The Pulse today, we're talking to a union worker who's trying to organize peer support workers in the downtown east side in harm reduction facilities. This comes in the wake of the murder of one harm reduction worker who was a peer support worker who had just saved a life half an hour before. Thomas Donaghy had a memorial last week we aired on the program. Now, Andrew Ledger, president of QP Local 1004 that represents Portland Hotel Society workers and is attempting to organize peer support workers in the community who are working for the sites, speaks about Thomas's death and the impact on labor organizing as peer workers demand accountability and labor rights across the sector and in many organizations. We'll talk to Andrew after our news today. And now for our news headlines. In our top story, two paramedics have been fired after a downtown Eastside patient was forced to crawl during a call for help and they didn't arrive with a stretcher or preparations for it. It was a ruling released last month by an arbitrator appointed by the Labor Relations Board. The incident occurred, according to the ruling, on October 15th last year, and the paramedics were fired because they, quote, neglected to care for the patient appropriately, allowing the patient to crawl to the elevator without assisting him and did not complete patient assessment on scene. The arbitrator ruled that the conduct fell short of appropriate standards of patient care, according to the ruling, and did not bring the necessary kit, either an AED, oxygen, suction, or even a stretcher to the scene. They did not document properly the matters they should have documented. The grievers were deceitful during an employer's investigation and at the hearing, according to the ruling. And, quote, in looking at all the circumstances, I am satisfied the employer's decision to terminate the grievers was not an excessive employer response to the proven misconduct. Both employees were defended by the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Local 873, who said that their dismissal was excessive response to a situation in which the patient was belligerent and aggressive. The union filed grievances on behalf of the two paramedics, alleging that employer did not have just cause to terminate them and that the Sikhs, that each grievers be given their jobs back. The patient of the incident was not named for privacy reading, but the judge ruled that, quote, the patient was humiliated by his treatment and serves no legitimate interest in naming him. According to the patient and his mother, in October 2019, they returned from Kelowna to Vancouver after spending Thanksgiving with family. The patient was dropped at his residence in the Woodwards building at 131 East Hastings, operated by Portland Hotel Society in the downtown east side. The patient is 56 years old and has a long-term drug addiction and methadone therapy involvement, denied they were using drugs at the time of the incident. The patient told mental health workers at the PHS site at Woodwards that he, quote, felt like death and was saying things that, quote, didn't make a lot of sense. The patient looked scared, nervous, and in a state where he did not appear to know what was going on. When paramedics arrived, the patient, they said, was flailing around, believing it to be a case of drug poisoning or overdose. According to video evidence presented in the trial, which the union challenged as edited, the judge rejected and said the video was in fact an accurate portrayal of events. It says that, quote, as the patient gets close to the elevator, it said that, quote, the first video shows the arrival of paramedics. The patient is observed crawling into the field of view of camera, and the video evidence shockingly reveals the patient crawling along the floor in the presence of a police officer and two paramedics who did not even have a stretcher. It took over a minute of the patient crawling while the paramedics and police watched before he got help. COVID-19 cases continue to rise in the province, reaching past 480 cases, a rise steadily over the past 2 weeks. The number of total cases has reached 4,100, with 3,500 recovered, and 195 people are dead. Canada-wide, there are now 121,000 total cases, with 4,600 active COVID patients, 9,000 deaths having been surpassed yesterday. And worldwide, the number of cases has neared 21 million, with now surpassing 750,000 deaths around the world. The United States remains the worst country for COVID, with 5.4 million cases, 50,000 new cases, and 170,000 deaths. And that's our news headlines for today on The Pulse. Welcome back. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio. I'm David Ball. You can find all of our previous interviews and podcasts at thepulse.cooperadio.org or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. On our show today, we're talking to Andrew Ledger. He's president of QP Local 1004. That's the Canadian Union of Public Employees. They represent Portland Hotel Society workers, but they're part of a union drive that's currently underway to organize peer support workers who make up the backbone, as he describes it, of the frontline harm reduction services, including overdose prevention sites. He talks about why the death of Thomas Donaghy after he was stabbed outside an overdose prevention site 2 weeks ago is a wake-up call for peer support workers to get the labor rights and respect they deserve. On Saturday, many of those peer workers will be marching alongside drug users and advocates and allies at Main and Hastings at noon in support and memorial of those who have died. That is a march organized by the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, and we'll be covering that on Saturday as well. Here's Andrew Ledger. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us here on The Pulse on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So we've been covering this last week, the tragic death of Thomas Donaghy, a peer support worker at the overdose prevention site at St. Paul's Hospital. And we carried his memorial service last week, in which a number of his coworkers had spoken about the tragic murder and kind of what it means to the people working in the sector and who people he helped. Just, do you have any thoughts to start out with about what it means to lose someone who's working in a field that you're working to protect?
I mean, it's nothing short of a tragedy. I was shocked when I found out some of our members who work at the PHS called me and let me know what had happened. And I was just very taken aback and couldn't believe that it had happened. It still shocks me today.
It truly devastating, and I think shocking for the community. And obviously, he was someone extremely well respected by his clients and coworkers. What are you hearing from the members around, you know, in the aftermath of him essentially being stabbed while he was on a break at work? He was in a workplace. This is obviously a safety issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wasn't working at, so we represent members of the PHS, and he wasn't working at a PHS site when the incident took place. But a lot of the safety issues are the same at any of the overdose prevention sites. When you're working in the downtown east side and you're working with the population that we're working with, there's always some level of risk to safety, and we do everything we can to support workers and make sure that they're in the safest possible environment at all times. And this incident sort of showed us that we need to do more.
Now, I'm gonna, like, one thing that's sort of, I think, important to clarify from the get-go is there's nothing dangerous per se about working with people with substance use issues or at harm reduction. And in fact, emergency room personnel in any hospital deal with actually threats to their safety all the time in any medical facility.
Absolutely. It's pervasive and not even just in the downtown east side. It could be any workplace. I mean, I see videos all the time of people working in restaurants who are being attacked because of COVID related issues and whatnot. So yeah. It's, you know, violence is part of every community, not just the downtown east side, for sure.
Now, the Hospital Employees Union has long raised concerns about nurses and orderlies being attacked by patients, and also just in being on a frontline open door that anyone can access throughout the day. I'm wondering what could be done to actually protect workers better in the sector to ensure they can offer the services to the important community that we live in here.
I mean, the philosophy that I've always taken is the best way to protect yourself is to have good relationships with the people that you're working with. That's always been the approach that I've taken when I worked in the downtown east side, and that when you have good relationships with people, you're a lot safer. I find putting in things like security guards and more policing tends to escalate situations and make things less safe, in my experience. But you have to sort of, it's a difficult line where you have to sort of balance worker safety with making sure that sites are accessible and inviting to people so that they want to actually use the sites. And that's part of the challenge of finding the right balance in relation to making sites safe.
Now, I've heard for years from people working in the front lines at any organization, whether it's PHS or Atira or Rain City or many others, where there seem to be either one or two staff on overnights often, and we're providing everything from nursing to social work to counseling to security to, you know, personal assistance and that kind of thing. There's a lot put on a very small number of people in often isolating situations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a serious challenge. And I know that the funding that's provided to the social service agencies in the downtown east side is lean. And the staffing complement for large buildings is often, you're right, it's often one, two, maybe three people to deal with, you know, to support, you know, 100, sometimes more individuals in a particular building. That does pose challenges. And when we have staffing shortages and you're having to work single staffed in those projects, it's all the more challenging. And I hear from our members every week that not having enough staff is putting them in difficult situations where they're not feeling as safe and supported as they need to be. And that's something that we are pushing for, at least with the PHS. And I'm sure other service agencies are doing the similar mm-hmm. things.
Now, Portland Hotel Society unionized not that long ago with you guys. I know a number of other frontline providers are with BCGU in the neighborhood. Can you talk about how unionizing or collective bargaining has changed the way that people think about or approach workplace safety in some of these frontline places?
Sure. I'll correct you quickly. Just so the PHS has been with 1004 since its inception. It was actually PHS kind of broke off from DERA, and DERA was also part of QP 1004. And so we've been the bargaining agent for the PHS for 20 plus years.
Okay, back to the Jim Green days. All right, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so our local has a long connection with the work in the downtown east side and are quite proud of that. That's part of that. But we've been working actively to organize the peer workers, and that's been happening. We've been taking the position for years now that peer employees are employees. That position is not shared with the PHS. They don't believe that to be the case, and so we've been battling with them since about 2016 on this question. What we've done now is we've done an organizing drive, and we have cast ballots with the Labor Relations Board, and those ballots are sitting now because we're trying to come to terms with the PHS that peer employees are in fact employees and are entitled to union representation. And we're in a fight with them about that right now. They don't agree. And so we've been trying to work that through with them for a number of months now, and we're kind of coming to the end of the line, and we'll likely be formally going back to the ballot box and just having the votes counted. But that is being opposed by the PHS, so they'll be putting in a submission contradictory to our position with the Labor Relations.
They're opposing the counting of the ballots. They want to exclude the
they're opposing the notion that peers are actual employees. That's what they don't agree with. They believe their position is that peer workers are not workers. Peer workers are recipients of therapeutic care. We take a different position. We say if you are working and you're being paid to work at the PHS and you receive paychecks and T4s and the like, you are absolutely an employee and therefore have the right to join a union and work collectively as workers to improve your health and safety, your wages, and a number of other factors that you would have as a unionized workforce.
Now, this is probably a very basic question for many of our listeners in the neighborhood, but for others, who are the peer workers and what's the history of them actually doing work in many of these facilities?
Yeah, so peer workers are members of the community. They're often folks that are living in and around the downtown east side. They may have a history of drug use. They may be actively drug users. And the role has really changed over the last number of years. When I started at the PHS over a decade ago, you know, there were peer employees at Insight and a few other sites around the downtown east side. But there was a large complement of workers who were, you know, doing small jobs, stipended work, around the community, a community cleanup and things like that. But what we've seen over the last number of years is a real focus on bringing more peers into the workforce because there's a lot of value in that. It helps make sites accessible and it helps give members of the community opportunities to work in their community, which is fantastic. The scope of work has really expanded with so many of the overdose prevention sites opening up and clinics opening up and having peers integrated into the real fabric of how those sites work has really amplified the nature of the work and amplified the number of peers actually working in the community. And so that's kind of the history. And so we've taken the position that they're workers and they should be treated accordingly and allowed to do things like join unions.
What kind of jobs are people doing? I know that, you know, some peers that would work for health authorities, for instance, or BCCSU would be essentially advisors and consultants and educators, essentially, both inward and outward. There are other jobs, obviously, it sounds like that people are doing that are, you know, very hands-on as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, The peer workers are the sort of the real front line of the front line in the downtown east side. In my experience, they're working side by side with healthcare workers at overdose prevention sites or at Insight or at community clinics. They're you know, responding to overdoses. They are supporting participants that are using the different sites. They are really integral to the entire operation. The sites couldn't run without them, and they're doing many of the same tasks and have many of the same responsibilities as the healthcare workers that are, you know, formal employees of the PHS. So we don't see a real distinction in the work that they're doing being particularly different from that of the sort of acknowledged healthcare workers that are part of those sites as well.
And as we saw from the case of Thomas Donaghy at the Rain City site at St. Paul's, he'd actually saved somebody's life from an overdose and reversed it just half an hour before he was stabbed.
And that's typical, right? That's happening every day, multiple times a day. These peers, employees are saving lives on a daily basis, if not hourly. Like that's valuable work. That's work that should be supported and acknowledged. And that's why we're troubled with this situation that we find ourselves in, where we're not seeing that the service providers are willing to acknowledge that key function that the workers are providing.
So what's your next step? Are you at the Labor Relations Board right now, or are things postponed for COVID, or how is this playing out in terms of your drive?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real, the timing of it couldn't have been worse, quite frankly. We held the vote back in March before COVID really took off, and then went to the Labor Board, and then COVID exploded and everything kind of shut down. And through that time, we've been trying to work with the PHS and the HEABC, which is the government organization that represents the PHS, to work through a way without formally going to the board to finish the process there. And that's taken time due to COVID and a number of other pieces that have been going on. But we're kind of getting to the end of our, we've I think exhausted that track and are going to be looking to go back to the labor board and have them adjudicate whether or not these employees are employees and then hopefully count the vote.
Just to step back a bit into the broader picture, it seems to be one of the front lines of the labor organizing today across Canada and in the States. We're looking at, you know, Uber and Lyft drivers being told they're not employees. In the past, I've been told in previous jobs that I wasn't an employee, just a contractor. People are expected to actually be doing frontline and very, you know, hands-on professional experience, often with their own equipment that's, you know, provided to them during work hours at a work site, but are not employees.
I agree with everything you're saying. The entire labor market is a disaster, and you know it's the contract working, sort of generally, as well as the sort of contract kind of piecework that the peers are doing. It's all part of a, you know, a systematic attack on working people across the country and across North America. It's a real challenge, and you know many unions are trying to find creative ways of organizing workers and getting workers together. I know for example, the Uber drivers down in Seattle organized with the Teamsters a number of years ago, you know, and the employers resist that at every turn. And that's part of the fight that organized labor is involved in across North America right now.
The recent incident and a number of violent incidents we've read about against the people you're trying to represent has really spurred maybe some further action or some further reflection.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that we're doing is, you know, we're talking to the peers regularly about health and safety concerns in their workplaces, and we are trying to work with the employer to engage with peers at like formal occupational health and safety committee meetings so that their issues are being articulated clearly by the actual workers to management. We're not coming up against particular resistance there, but it hasn't come to fruition yet. So that's something that we're working on as a way of trying to really let the service providers understand what it is that peer workers need. And I want them to hear it directly from those peer workers' voices, because that's the right way to go as far as I'm concerned.
Well, any last thoughts before we let you go, Andrew?
No, I really appreciate your interest. This is something that I'm quite passionate about personally, and we're excited to fulfill the long-standing piece of work about organizing peers, and we hope that when we're able to achieve that other groups of peer workers don't come up against the same kind of challenges that the PHS peers are focusing or are dealing with right now. I would like to see a world where peer employees are actually respected in a way that is appropriate, because I don't see that necessarily being the case right now. So I'm hopeful for a world in the very near future where peers are given the respect that they deserve.
Thank you so much for your time. Great to have you on, and look forward to having you back.
Great. Take care.
You too. Take care. Stay healthy. And that was Andrew Ledger. He's president of QP Local 1004, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, representing Portland Hotel Society workers and currently organizing a drive to organize and unionize the peer support workers who make up the backbone of many services in the downtown east side. And many of them, as I mentioned earlier, are marching on Saturday at noon at Main and Hastings with other drug users and allies for a memorial for those who have died of overdoses during the COVID-19 emergency.
And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.